Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Next Friday, the 2024 Olympic Games will be underway in Paris, France. The Summer Olympics come around every 4 years and showcase remarkable talent from around the world in myriad events. And yes, it is a competition between elite athletes, but it's also a competition between nations to see which country can collect the most bronze, silver, and gold medals. Mostly, it's a friendly competition among participants and nations, but politics also enters the picture. Perhaps one of the most famous examples of that is the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. It quickly became a coming-out party for Adolf Hitler. Germany, decimated by their defeat in World War I, was beginning to rebound under his leadership, but much of the rest of the world was concerned about, even fearful of, Germany's turn to fascism. Hitler used the 1936 Games as a vehicle for propaganda, with the Nazis promoting an image of a new, strong, and united Germany, even as they masked the regime's targeting of Jews and others, and the nation's growing militarism. This led some nations, for the first time, to call for a boycott of the Games. But that attempt failed. 49 nations attended the Games, and some believe that legitimized Hitler's regime, both in the eyes of Germans and of the rest of the world. The drama of the Games themselves was surrounded by the political drama that would eventually lead to World War II, and much of it is captured in a new historical novel, Played. The Games of the 1936 Berlin Olympics. It is the work of our guests this hour, Glenn Allen and Richard Kaufman, and they join us now. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
I'm not sure which of you to, since you worked together on this project, I'm not sure which of you to ask these questions of. So we'll just play pickleball and I'll just throw it to you and you can take it up as you want. And I'll start with you, Glenn. The story of the 1936 Olympics and the run-up to World War II, you know, it's compelling in and of itself, but you have framed it in the context of an historical novel. Since your characters in this book are all, were all, real people, why that approach as opposed to simply writing it as nonfiction?
Well, the main reason is that me and Rick are filmmakers first, and we were actually making an independent film that we both wrote and produced. I directed, Rick starred in it, and he brought me this magazine. It was in German. It was all about the 1936 Olympics. And I was initially intrigued by the combination, the mix of sports and politics. I was, because we're both sports fans, we're big into history and politics. So we thought, well, this might make a great movie script. And then as we got further into researching it, it became bigger and bigger and bigger. And that was in the mid-90s. We've been researching this material. And, you know, the reason to fictionalize it, even though everything in the book is true, is that we do want to see this as a TV series one day. That's what we're trying to do.
And not a documentary. You want to dramatize it.
Exactly. The same way the book is not a history book, it is a novel, an entertaining novel.
Richard, you opened the book with a note to the reader, the first sentence of which poses the question, would the Holocaust have happened had the U.S. boycotted the 1936 Berlin Olympics? And that plays into something I just spoke about in the opening a moment ago, that failed attempt by some nations to boycott these games. You say it's a question that can't be answered, but one which is fair to ask. But let me ask you your take. Let me get your personal takes on this, Richard. Okay. What do you think? Did our participation, lead to the Holocaust by legitimizing Hitler?
Well, I'm going to give you a little back history of my family. My family are German Jews on my father's side. And my whole life, I had been told by my great uncle the story of how he was denied the right to participate in the Winter Games that year, also held in Germany. Because he was Jewish. He was one of the best downhill skiers in all of Germany, and he was denied the right. So, I'm going to start there and then say, in 1938, my family had to escape Nazi Germany. And I mean, with their lives, with nothing. So I think in that interim, in 36, when the world had the opportunity to say, oh no, we're not going there. We're not going to give this man any validation at all. Everyone knew politically what was going on in Germany. They knew the Jews were getting rounded up. It was public news, the laws that were being passed against Jews and blacks in Germany and others, the Roma. So to answer your question, yeah, I really do believe we could have curbed the Nazi activity if we would have had enough nerve to say, absolutely not. We're
Well,
not going.
the Olympics are not a governmental operation. They're a non-governmental organization. But even
True.
if and I'm what you say in the book is true. It's historical fiction, but the fiction comes, I think, from the dialogue, which you could not have known what these people said to each other. But the
Exactly.
events are in fact true, and you do write about how the American Olympic Committee removed a couple of Jewish athletes at the last minute. We'll talk about that later at some depth in the program, but that they did it because they were Jewish and they didn't want to offend Hitler. I mean, that sounds ridiculous today, but that's what happened, right?
It's absurd. I mean, our main antagonist is Avery Brundage, and he ran the American Olympic Committee. And he was friends with all these people on the German Olympic Committee who were also on the IOC, which is where Brundage wanted to be. And he wasn't going to be on the IOC if he didn't get our team to Berlin. And in fact, when we got there, he acquiesced to these people and kicked off the only two Jews we had on the entire team. Whatever, any sport, they were the two runners on the 4x100 relay. And this is the whole reason why Jesse Owens got his chance to win the fourth gold. Now, everybody loves Jesse. How can you not? It was a great achievement. But no one really knows the backstory of how he was able to get that fourth goal. And we tell that story.
Okay, Glenn.
I'm going to say Avery Brundage, who Rick mentioned, he was a notorious anti-Semite throughout his whole career. So he didn't care about the politics. His motivation was to be on the International Olympic Committee, which he did achieve, and then became president ultimately for years.
Any big event, such as and the Olympics, are bigger today than they were, I would think, in 1936, because television has made them so. And the fact that they're every 2 years now, as opposed to every 4 years for television, not for any other reason, has changed the nature of it. But even back then, whenever you have a big event like that, it can become used as a vehicle for politics and political propaganda. Are they all like that, or was this an outlier?
I think they're all, to some degree, they are. That one in 36, of course, was huge for the Nazis. But you see it, you saw it in Sochi when the anti-gay laws were established. You see it in the World Cup, all kinds of corruption and political agendas being, thrown into this arena because it gets so much attention.
And money is a key issue as well, because everybody wants the money that comes from these. The 1936 Olympics were given to Germany, as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, in 1931. That was before Hitler rose to power. So they were kind of locked in with these games being in Berlin at that point. But once he did come to power and his intentions were becoming more and more obvious, the United States and other nations had this opportunity to withdraw, to boycott the games. They did not, despite concern over Hitler's racist policies and human rights violations at the time. This is prior to the Holocaust and the pogroms, etc., then the herding Jews into ghettos. And prior to Kristallnacht. In 2017, Forbes magazine ran an article stating that then President Donald Trump's rhetoric, policies, and executive orders were endangering our country's bid to host the 2024 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. We know that we didn't get that bid. It went to Paris, where they start next week. LA, however, will get the 2028 games, but Donald Trump could be back in the White House in 2028. So there are those who say that when you listen to what he is saying today about America, the America that he would like to create, where he would like to take the country, what he would like to do to democracy, what is laid out in Project 2025, his policies would also limit rights. He might also be viewed as racist, or at least these policies could be. If Trump were to win and pursue that agenda, would other nations boycott the LA Games? I'm not sure if you can answer that question. I'm going to throw it out there, though.
Well, you know, it's funny. There was an argument by the Germans to the Americans when the Americans on the Olympic Committee, the IOC, the Janky, he was the American ambassador there. He said that, you know, he didn't think we should go, and he was fighting the Germans tooth and nail. And the Germans said, hey, look at your own racist laws. They could have said the same thing in 32 and held back because, you know, half the United States, African Americans were drinking out of a different water fountain. They couldn't go to the same bathrooms. I mean, we were really bad. You know, now we wrote this book and we want the reader to judge on their own what they see politically to what's going on now in America. But it is quite clear to us as the writers that Donald Trump is saying a lot of things almost exactly to what Hitler said. And it is frightening that his people don't recognize that.
Well, make America great again is a good example. That phrase, make America, right there. Make Germany great again.
That's right.
That was used back then. And I had a Holocaust survivor on this program several years ago. And this is prior to Trump coming to office the first time, saying that she was alarmed by what she saw as echoes of the past, the rhetoric, the policies, the attitudes, et cetera. And she said, mark my words, we're beginning the same process over again. Of course, when you're in the middle of something, it's often difficult to understand what's going on around you and really see it for what it ends up being, something that you can only see years and years later. And as you point out, we study history in order to move forward without repeating the mistakes of the past. You call this your, quote, fictionalized account of the insanity and hysteria that ensued in Germany, the United States, and around the world from 1931 to 1936. There does seem to be a stream of hysteria and politics in many of the Western nations, although in France they just thwarted off right-wing hysteria but through an election. Do you see this as a repeat of that period? Are we going through this again, Glenn?
In a way, I do. I think people should look at this Olympics coming up very carefully, because there are a lot of parallels. You mentioned, you know, Trump saying "Make America Great Again," and Hitler's one of his slogans being "Make Germany Great Again." Another one was the lying press. I think the German word is the Lügenpresse or whatever. Same as fake news, right? So, I think people, what we want people to do when they read the book is to look at what's happening around us now and see what we can learn from those lessons and apply that to today. And I think people will find many parallels.
One of the things that fictionalizing history does, I presume, is to make it more approachable, more easily accessible to people because they get caught up in the drama of the story. I guess the danger of it, however, the flip side of that coin, is that they see it as fiction and not as real. So when we come back, I want to talk about how you think people should approach this book and how they can parse the fictional dialogue from the reality of these people and what happened and what they did. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Glenn Allen and Richard Kaufman. They are the co-authors of an historical novel called Played, The Games of the 1936 Berlin Olympics. We're talking to them on the eve of the 2024 Paris Olympics. And this is historical fiction. The characters in this book are all real. There's no made-up individual here. What happened in this book, the events that occur, are all real. They've chosen to make this a fictionalized approach. And what makes it fiction, I guess, is the dialogue that is not documented, the things that happen between these characters behind the scenes that the average person never saw. And that's where the fiction comes in. And I'm wondering, and I know I talked a minute ago about why you would approach it this way, because A, you want to make it a movie or a limited TV series, but B, dramatizing things is a lot less dry than a documentary approach. You draw people in, so they actually learn more and are affected more by what they're reading, or in the case of a movie or TV show, seeing. But does it also run the risk of people dismissing it as fiction? Well, that didn't really happen. It's just fiction.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I think one of the main reasons why we approached it the way we did is we really want the reader to learn about these people. We want the reader to get into their everyday lives and see how it was to be living in this hysteria on the American side, on the German side, on the political side, on the athlete side, all going towards the same goal of going to the Olympics, but really learning these characters and their everyday lives. And that's what makes this special. I mean, that's really why we wanted to dramatize the dialogue, because we really wanted people to get into their lives and know what it was like. And I think that's a big part of this, is you really get to know these characters. And there's a lot of them.
Glenn.
And also, you learn about the issues that were happening through these relationships.
Yep.
For example, Leni Riefenstahl falls in love with an American decathlete, this, you know, farm boy from Colorado. And you get to see the pressure she was under. There's debate whether she was Nazi or not. And we go into that in the book. But through her romance, and this book is filled with romance and comedy and drama and a spy story. It has all the elements of a great series. Great page turner as well. But, you know, you get to learn about the events through people, even Hitler. We don't sympathize with Hitler, but we go into this passage where we learn that he's thinking about his father, who he hated, he used to beat him regularly. And his father owned bee cages. It's very interesting. And he would dream at night of ways to destroy his father's bee cages. You think of that, and then you think about what happens years later in the Holocaust. And it's very, so, you know, again, he's not a sympathetic character, but he's a human character.
Right.
In a way, that's more frightening than the comic book monster that we see in movies.
I think also to understand this period and to apply it perhaps to our own, you have to forget what you know and what you think about that period today. We have learned about the horrors of Nazi Germany. We have learned about the delusions that Hitler operated under. We have learned what he did in the Holocaust and the millions of people that he put to death for absolutely no reason whatsoever, just his own pathology. But back then, we didn't know all that stuff. We were in the midst of it all, and we were questioning whether or not what we were hearing was true. And there were Nazis in America. There were people who sympathized with the Nazis and who acted on behalf of the Nazis in the United States Congress, none of whom came to any kind of trial or justice at the end of World War II. So are you telling this story to help us get a better idea of what that period was like and what it feels like to negotiate the mushiness of current events? Or are you telling it simply because it's a great story?
Well, both, actually. And we also want people to know that, or to understand, and this relates to today, that the Holocaust didn't happen overnight.
Right.
And we got it back, it's, you know, 90 years ago, 80 years ago, and you think, people think, how could that have happened? Well, it didn't happen overnight. This is a decade in the making. Mm-hmm. Our story is it shows a little piece of how that could have happened.
Some people believe that the 1936 Olympics are the most important Olympic Games in history because of what was going on surrounding them in Nazi Germany at the time, and how the world turned a blind eye, essentially, to what was going on because they played in the Games. In fairness to the people involved in 1936, it should be said that it's often difficult to understand the world around you at the time that you're living through it. And this story seems to make that abundantly clear. Does it become a cautionary tale then?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, you read it and you see the parallels, and if you don't take caution, you're not getting it, you know. But I do want to say that the athletes on every side, on the German side, on the American side, everybody had pressure, especially the German athletes, those poor people, you know, they were young, and they just wanted to compete and be the best at their event. You know, they knew that they, you know, get this opportunity. Plus, they wanted to travel and meet different cultures. And, you know, so like you said, they didn't realize what was going on. That wasn't their focus. Now, the politicians, on the other hand, they should have been a bit more savvy. And some of them were, and were ignored. You know, our ambassador, Dodd, who was the American ambassador to Germany, completely ignored by the State Department, because the people working under Secretary of State Cordell Hull, they were these people, Ivy Leaguers, who thought that Dodd wasn't even capable of doing the job. So they were ignoring him and not even getting his letters to the Secretary of State. So really, the politicians did know the gravity of what was happening, but they just didn't want to accept it, or even they ignored it, like you said.
But as I said, there were people in the United States Congress not only sympathizing with the Nazi movement and thinking that maybe this is where America should go. We should dump democracy and go to a more authoritarian form of government, which we are going through today again. And many of them were unwittingly and wittingly working for the Nazi regime. And people were that, so they were working against people who were noticing this and popping their head up and saying, "Hey, wait, stop." So yeah. there were headwinds. Let me talk about the two of you, because you're co-authors of this book. You both have successful careers in film and television. Glenn, you have a highly successful career in that industry. You've worked on hundreds of projects. You've won 2 Emmys as a visual effects producer for HBO's Boardwalk Empire. I love that series, by the way. You worked with Martin Scorsese and Aaron Sorkin and Ron Howard and Brian De Palma and Tim Burton, and the list goes on and on. Richard, you also spent your career in television with, as you mentioned, a keen interest in sports and also history. The both of you have your own production company. So how did the two of you initially meet? Where did all this begin? Because you've been working on this book for 20 years.
Well, we met in college. We were actually fraternity brothers at Emerson College, where we both studied film and acting, in Rick's case, and writing. And I quickly got a job in the industry in post-production. And that's when we started writing together. And we wrote scripts, then we decided to make our own film. Now we have numerous award-winning scripts, and we just won an award on a short film we made during the pandemic last week. So we just have a good writing relationship. And I've worked with a lot of people who collaborate together on films, and I've seen that collaborations work best, I think, when it comes to making films.
So you're both storytellers, and Richard, you mentioned you have a personal interest in this era of history because of your family connections to the Holocaust, etc., and Nazi Germany. But and I know this was supposed to be in your minds, it was going to be a television miniseries and may yet become one.
Yes.
But you decided to turn it into a book. Why? Was that to capture the attention of Hollywood producers, or was it simply wanted to get the story out?
Well, you know, it's a combination of both. So, you know, originally, you know, like we had said, we'd gotten this in mind, you know, we had it in mind as a series, and we had some pretty big people involved at some point when it came to doing a limited series, and including a couple of Oscar winning writers who were interested in telling the story, and a big studio. However, we kept getting told that we should write the book. you should write the book. You've got enough material here. You can own the rights to it. It's your story. You know, you tell it best, you know, and we just said, yeah, let's go for it. Let's write the book. And we were determined to get the story out. I mean, it's quite epic and sweeping and touching, you know, when the athletes go to the games and they start winning and you followed these people's lives, you know, for 5 years, 6 years, it's pretty moving, you know, it brings tears to your eyes. So, you know, we really wanted to tell the story.
Glenn.
And also, when you go to pitch Hollywood, it's hard to walk in there with an idea.
Yeah.
Everyone has great ideas. I hear it all the time. I have a great idea for a movie. Can you tell Ron Howard? It doesn't work that way.
No.
You know, intellectual property, IP, you may have heard that term. We thought we'd have a better chance of making this if we had that IP and own it.
Yeah.
Herman Woke wrote two novels that are just wonderful, and they became television miniseries, The Winds of War and War and Remembrance, which are, to use your word, Richard, are sweeping sagas of the buildup to and the execution of World War II. And he mixes in real characters with fictional characters. The lead characters, in fact, are completely fictionalized. Yep. You don't do that. Which is the better approach? And why didn't you feel that you needed to make up characters?
Well, it's funny. I do love those books. I do love those miniseries. When I was a kid, I was all over it. You know, being a history buff, I was all over it. However, we had done enough research where the drama was falling right into our laps with these people. I mean, they were all interacting anyway. And we were just finding more and more of the drama in the reality. We didn't have to make up any people, you know, what we were doing and the approach we were taking, you know, as filmmakers, we really love the likes of Robert Altman and how he can get a bunch of characters weaving in and out, you know, and we keep that in mind for this, but they're all such juicy stories and the way we intertwine them, it works. So we just felt there was absolutely no need to make up any characters because we had, you know, Gretel Bergman's family, which were German Jews, which, you know, what happened there was an amazing story about how she was used as a pawn just to get the Americans over there. And I mean, there were just so many. Eleanor Holm, you know, her story, you know, I mean, that's just amazing, too. She became she was an athlete who was kicked off the team the day they got to Germany because Brundage hit on her and she refused it. I mean, there was just so much drama that we felt, let's just tell this story from the people who lived it.
And Glenn, you've been working on this for 20 years. I would think that much of that time was spent in research, making sure you had your facts straight on this. How much, divide it up for me, how much time was spent in writing the book and editing the book and getting it ready for publication versus doing the research and finding out about these people and the stories they had to tell?
Well, like you said, we researched this for many, many years, but we also had day jobs. So we came to a project and, you know, figuring out, is it a movie, is it a series? And then, of course, streaming services went crazy. And we said, oh, this is perfect for a 10-episode series. And we actually wrote a script. We outlined a whole series, which became the impetus for the book. And then we wrote, probably the first draft took about 2 years.
Yeah.
And then we spent another year on a rewrite. Yeah. All in all, about 3 years.
Yeah.
We're talking about the Glenn Allen and Richard Kaufman's book, Played, The Games of the 1936 Berlin Olympics. It's historical fiction. And when writers write historical fiction, or when screenwriters write a movie based on what happened in real life, they have to create dialogue. Because you just can't say this happened and then that happened. You have to actually have conversations between people that lead up to those things happening. And some of this dialogue might, if you're lucky, come from the historical record because somebody wrote it down or somebody recorded it. But sometimes, and most often I would think, there is no historical record, particularly of meetings that took place between people over cocktails or behind the scenes. So you have to craft what they might have said. How do you approach that when you're dealing with real people? All of these people are real people. All of these incidents are real incidences. How do you make the dialogue fit into their mouths,
yeah,
tell the story that actually happened and not embellish or make things up?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we are screenwriters, so we have to put dialogue in people's mouths that we make up all the time. However, it's easier actually to do what we did in this book because we knew that some of these meetings actually took place. So, you know, with these real people who we had researched and we really got to know each character, and each character is very much alive, it was easier to write for them and have these conversations between the characters that we had done so much research on anyway. So it came a lot easier to do this with real people than it is when we're writing screenplays and completely making up characters, because we knew the intentions of these people already.
Go ahead.
And I'll give you an example. I just thought of Eva Braun, who was Hitler's girlfriend, yeah, at the time. So we know what her personality was like through history, but what was said, we didn't know. However, you put her in the situation she was in. She wanted to be seen as the First Lady of Germany. Yeah. Hitler didn't want that.
Yeah.
Hitler's entourage did not want that. So we used our imagination to say, what did they talk about?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, of course, we'll never know exactly, but we have a really good idea.
Well, I guess that's my question. I mean, you're writing historical fiction, and you want the story to be true, as true as it can be, so that people can really get out of it what you intend and what, yeah, actually happened. How do you know that you have been true to the moment and to the character, that what the words that you're putting in their mouth, even though they didn't possibly really say them, they were maybe, uh-huh, thinking them, it surrounded their relationships. How do you know it's true to the character and you are not taking them down a path that they would never have taken in real life?
Well, through our research, you know, we've listened to lots of interviews with a lot of these athletes, and they'll say, oh, in the room, you should have seen, you know, or what Jesse said. No, that's not how it happened. You know, and so we, through the research, is really the answer. We tried to be loyal to who these people are, yeah, as much as we possibly could.
Yeah. So when we come back, I want to take a look at some of these real characters. These were real people that are characters in this book, and the story that they tell and the things that they did. And we'll do that with Glenn Allen and Richard Kaufman, co-authors of Play, the Games of the 1936 Berlin Olympics, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Glenn Allen and Richard Kaufman. They're both in the film and television industry, but together they have researched and collaborated on writing a new historical novel about the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games called Played. And that's a play on words, in that the games were played against the backdrop of the rise of Nazism in Germany and against some of the misgivings that some nations had about going there, but they all went anyway. When you write fiction, when you write a story that you are aiming to be a good page-turner book or a great miniseries for television, it has to have a lot of different ingredients. And one of the ingredients most of these have in common is sex and romance. Now, I don't know about the sex, but there's a lot of romantic relationships in here among real people. Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun, you just mentioned them. The relationship between Leni Riefenstahl and Glenn Morris, the U.S. decathlon athlete, and several others as well. How do you explain this abundance of unusual, unlikely, often romantic relationships in this era and at this Olympic Games?
Well, you know, I don't think it's unusual. I mean, if you look at the ages of these people, I mean, nothing has changed in human nature, right? I mean, and I think that is a testament of what we tried to do. You know, these are all real people. And in the case of Hitler and Eva Braun, it makes it even scarier that they were given the keys to the kingdom. But they were real. They had real urges. And the, you know, we were trying to make an entertaining novel, and we did not want to miss out on the absolute animalistic quality of humankind.
Well, let's talk about Leni Riefenstahl, because some of these characters are really well known, others not so much. And I think she falls somewhere in the middle, because if you know anything about German cinema and what her role was in chronicling Hitler's regime in Germany, she was the leading filmmaker for Adolf Hitler. A lot of those scenes that we see scattered throughout documentaries now were shot by her, and much of what she did as a filmmaker has largely been imitated over time, in terms of how she shot things and how she put them together to make a cohesive film. But she's a German. She clearly, if she's not a Nazi herself, she clearly has sold herself to the Nazis for most of the war, and yet she f strikes up this relationship with Glenn Morris, the U.S. decathlon athlete. I don't think he was a Nazi, so how did they meet? How did they allow this? How was it allowed that this kind of relationship blossomed?
Well, Leni had a lot of power. Hitler gave her carte blanche. She had, at the time, it was the most expensive documentary ever made. This is Olympia, which she was making. She really, Hitler loved her. And she was conflicted in a way. She meets Glenn Morris at the Olympic Village, where she's filming. He's enamored by her because he's not used to being around a woman like this, super intelligent, talented, powerful. And they hit it off, and it was almost like opposites attracted. It was almost love at first sight. And on their deathbeds, they both professed their love for one another and their regret for not fulfilling that the romance
Well,
that they had.
there's a scene in your book where the two of them are having what is described as a final conversation before the Olympic Games are over and everybody scatters to the winds, and they're crossing a bridge. I think they're crossing a bridge, and they're having this conversation where he invites her to come with him to America, and she invites him to stay there, and of course they don't, and they separate and they go their way. Do we know that that conversation happened? Here's this farm boy from America talking to this very sophisticated and powerful woman in Germany. Did that conversation really happen? Are we to assume that it did in fact happen?
Well, I mean, I think we have to assume that since they called each other their greatest loves on their deathbed, to say goodbye, there must have been some sort of conversation where they had to say goodbye, and it must have been very difficult. But I do believe in our research, we did find out that each other wanted each other to stay. You know, for sure. I mean, Hitler thought that Glenn Morris was a perfect athlete. You know, he wanted him training German athletes. So, yeah, I mean, again, whether the exact words were said, obviously we don't know that, but certainly the conversation took place.
So at the heart of this story, and I guess you could call him the lead character in this, is Avery Brundage. His name is semi-familiar to most people alive today if you're a sports fan or you know much about the Olympics, but many people have never heard of Avery Brundage. Talk about who he was, the role he plays in this story, and the role he played in history.
Well, Avery was an Olympic athlete himself, 1912 in Stockholm. And that's where he met his German friends. And then he was also his father was a real estate developer and builder. He had a lot of money. So money was not his motivation. He was also bitter. He was beaten by Jim Thorpe in the 1912 Olympics. And that may have fueled his racism. He never got over it. He was bitter about that. So his motivation was power. And he vied to get on the International Olympic Committee, which, as we know, he did finally get there.
That was his ambition. He was the president of the American Olympic Committee with ambitions to be named to the International Olympic Committee. He is described in your book as unmoved by the Nazi anti-Jewish rhetoric and doctrines, and evidently he fought really hard to get the American team to Germany for those games. How much of a struggle was it to get the team to go?
Well, the athletes wanted to go. I mean, they were, you know, the Jewish athletes wanted to go because they wanted to stick it to Hitler. The same with the black athletes, they wanted to stick it to Hitler. You know, I mean, they were even savvy to what was going on over there. And It was difficult to go because I there was this vote, and the AAU, which was the American Amateur Athletic Union, they were in charge of all the athletes. And the head of that, Judge Jeremiah Mahoney, who was a great man, a Medal of Honor winner, he was in charge of them, and he was not going to chance it. He did not want to go. And he was working with the IOC American representative, Janke, and Dodd to work on our main protagonist, Alan Gould, who was the AP sports editor. They were working on
Right.
him to try to, get this in the news that we shouldn't go, we shouldn't go, we shouldn't go. And so it was Mahoney who brought up the vote, whether we should go or not, and that's why it went to a vote.
This is a very dramatic moment in the book. The vote was 56 to 52 to go, and Judge Jeremiah Mahoney led the efforts to boycott, and as a result of that vote, he resigned from the American Athletic Union. Avery Brundage had won this fight, and Glenn, you say that it changed sports forever. How so?
Well, it gave politics some power over athletes. Roosevelt did not want to be he didn't want any part of this at first. He was approached by Jewish leaders, and he said, "Well, we're not really getting involved." But how did it change sports forever? They were used as pawns, basically, for Brundage's agenda. If Americans didn't go to the games, there's no chance he would have had to be on the International Committee. It was his friends were in Germany were telling him, "Get the Americans over here, and you'll have a shot." And also, I wanted to say one of the ways they won the vote, he had ties to the mafia
Oh, yeah.
through his building and real estate and construction money
In
in Chicago.
Chicago.
So people who were voting were coerced.
You write, Hitler knew, I don't know how he learned this, where it came from, but he understood the power of pictures, the power of image, long before the rest of us. Today it's second nature, but back then film was just becoming into its own, etc. And he knew how to put on a show like somebody else we could talk about, but we won't. And the Olympics is nothing if it's not pomp and pageantry and ceremony. And a lot of the things that we take for granted today came from the 1936 Olympics. You write about how during the traditional parade of nations, athletes from around the world entered the stadium as they do today, but as they passed Hitler's reviewing box, they lowered their own flags and gave him the stiff arm Nazi salute, which he returned. The American team did not. They raised the flag and did not salute him. They put their hands over their hearts just to tick him off. Who made the decision for our athletes not to participate in the Heil Hitler salute?
Oh, that was the athletes. I mean, Brundage didn't know about it. He would have been pissed off. But no, this was the athletes. They decided, when they were watching this, they couldn't believe that the other athletes were actually giving salutes. And they were talking amongst themselves, like, "Wow, this is crazy. We're not going to do that. We're Americans." And so they, as a group of like 300, they decided, "Hell no, we don't go that way." And they raised it higher and they put their hand over their heart and they were very, very proud Americans. They were just not going to do that.
So let's talk about another of the key characters, the American Associated Press sports editor Alan Jay Gould, who you talk about a lot. He's the protagonist. He went to Berlin to cover these games. It is through his eyes that we more clearly see Brundage's relationship with the Nazis, along with other aspects of the story, including the pressure that the Nazis put on their athletes. How would you describe Brundage's relationship with the Nazis, or with Elliot Gould, for that matter? Alan
Well,
Gould, excuse me.
cool. Elliot Gould. We'll get him to play him.
That's right.
Alan Gould, he's kind of like the moral compass of the story, because as the reader, you're kind of seeing these things through his eyes. We refer to him a lot. He's reporting back to the U.S. He speaks to his wife. He has personal relationships with these athletes, including Eleanor Holm, who, after rejecting Brundage's sexual advances, she gets kicked off the team. Well, Alan Gould hires her to cover the rest of the games, which further ticked off Brundage. And so Brundage and Gould, they had a very adversarial
Oh,
relationship, obviously. But Gould
yes.
was there, to witness everything. And that's, a lot of the book is seen through his eyes.
We know a lot about Hitler's attitudes about Jewish people because of the Holocaust, but it wasn't his attitudes, his negative attitudes, his incorrect attitudes were not limited to the Jews. He felt the same way about gay people. He felt the same thing about anybody who was not an Aryan. A member of the so-called Aryan race,
Yeah,
and that would
scary.
include black people. Jesse Owens is perhaps the most famous athlete to emerge from this 1936 games. He and Ralph Metcalf replaced Marty Glickman, who became famous later on for being a sports commentator, and Sam Stoller. They replaced them both in the 400-meter relay, thanks to the American Olympic Committee. Many believe that the AOC did not want to offend Hitler by putting Jewish athletes on the team, so they took them off. Why did they care?
Well, Brundage at that point had realized he was being used and or had been used. And he was they threatened him. They said, look, we got you on the IOC, because they kicked Jahnke out, the other American. They kicked him out because he kept on like, we can't go, we can't go. So they thought, all right, we'll kick him out because he doesn't have the Olympic ideals, but we'll get Brundage in. And they got him in right away before they even landed in Germany. So then they were able to have the power to say, if you don't kick these Jews off, we're going to kick you out of the IOC as well. So he was coerced into it. I really don't think he had a huge problem with it, because like Glenn said, he was an anti-Semite. He was part of the Chicago Country Club, where it was quite clear on the bottom of their menu that said no Jews allowed.
If Hitler was offended by the presence of Jews and had plans for their extermination, why replace these two guys with Jesse Owens, a black man?
Well, one of the things I think at that point, Hitler realized that the track and field events were being dominated by blacks. It was
Right.
no surprise. Jesse had won three golds by that point.
Yeah.
So yeah, he was annoyed that blacks were winning, but even more annoyed if Jewish runners had won.
Yeah, because other Jewish athletes from other countries won Olympic, won gold and won silver, and Hitler hated it, but they knew, the Germans knew that they had power over Brundage, so they knew that the only two Jews were in the same event, and that they could easily get him to say, make up a reason for them not to participate.
And in your book, there's a scene between Jesse Owens and a college professor where the professor asks students in a business course about the ethics of a CEO partnering with Hitler. And Jesse Owens was one of those students. He said he would pass on business, but when pressed on whether he would compete in the Olympics, knowing that the money would go into Nazi coffers, he replied it would be sweet to beat the Aryan race and show the world what a black man is capable of. So he had legitimate reasons for wanting to be a part of this. And something else that comes up in this book, and I only have about 30 seconds left, is that Germans, despite their antipathy and distrust and disgust with Jews, actively tried to recruit Jewish German expatriates who might have been Jewish. Am I correct about this? To give the appearance that they were not anti-Jewish.
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the main reasons. Gretel Bergman is the best example. She's one of our bigger characters. She was the lead high jumper, woman high jumper in all of the world. And her family was, they put a lot of pressure on them to get her back from London, where she had originally escaped.
It is a fascinating story that is, I think, destined for TV, but I've been wrong 1,000 times before, and it's hard to get things done on television, but it's in the book. and you can read it. Glenn Allen and Richard Kaufman, co-authors of Played, the Games of the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Thank you both for the hour. Good luck with the story.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.